This is the Medicast, April 16th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 62. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this week's episode. It's been an interesting week for me. I had the joy of taking my 8-year-old daughter up for a colonoscopy to look at some issues she has going on. Thankfully, they didn't find anything that they were worried about finding, so that's good news for me, but it certainly has had me running around, and as always, I get a chance to watch very good doctors at the Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children and how they really work well with kids and work on learning their child assessments and really getting down to deal with the kids. You know, we were parents, but we were really secondary, and they addressed questions and comments to us, but it was really all about my daughter, and I certainly appreciate all of the great care from the physicians and nurses and the rest of the staff at that hospital. Just a fantastic job. Well, enough of that. Moving right on into the show, I want to welcome all of you and thank you again for checking out the show, especially all of you brand new listeners. Make sure you check out a few episodes and get a sense of what the Medicast is all about. And also, check out and send in comments or questions or even criticisms, if they're constructive, or corrections on things that I may have misspoken or had some bad information on. This is a way for us all to share information. And when you guys send in comments like that, it gives me an opportunity to share that with everyone else that listens to the show and ultimately makes all of us better providers. So keep up the good work and keeping all of those great comments coming in. Speaking of listener comments and questions, I want to thank Raphael, who's a new listener to the show, who sent in a comment about last week's episode on gynecological assessment and the pneumococcal vaccine, and he just wanted to let me know that he found the podcast very informative and was checking out other episodes. And I want to thank you for your comments, Raphael, and welcome to the show. And I urge the rest of you, if you haven't looked at the website at medicast.com, you can check out all of the back episodes over there by clicking on the link for podcasts and going back into the archives and checking out old episodes. The show is published weekly. I think I've missed one week in the last year because I just was too sick to put the show out that week. But other than that, the show has been coming together every week with some great information, or at least what I hope is great information from everybody out there. And based on the comments from listeners like Raphael, that is the case, and I will keep working hard at achieving that goal. I also got a comment from listener Matt. Matt's a firefighter paramedic working in the Flagstaff, Arizona area for the last 3 years, and he was enjoying the show. And I just wanted to thank him for his comments as well. Keep up the good work. Originally, he was in the West Virginia area and not too far from my area here on the East Coast. So I wish you luck in your endeavors there, Matt, and keep the questions, comments, and other information coming in. I really appreciate that. Finally, I got an email from listener Ben, who is a member of the UVM Rescue and College EMS Squad, and he just wanted me to know that the University of Vermont Rescue Squad is alive and well, working hard at maintaining their ALS professional level of transport and all of the great mutual aid programs that they have in place because of their superior quality. And I just wanted to point out that, again, just because you're a member of a college EMS squad or a volunteer EMS squad, as my service is here in my area, doesn't mean that you aren't of the quality of other EMS squads in busier metropolitan areas and paid services. The call volume might be a little bit different. The patient demographic might be a little bit different, But you know, we all reach the same levels of certification, and we all train very hard to get to where we are. And we don't need to be putting each other down or trash talking each other because, well, you see 7 stabbings a week because you work in a major city, and maybe I only see 1 or 2 a year. And that doesn't mean that we're any less trained. It just means that we work in a different area and actually have very different challenges, things that we have to put up with to maintain our certifications because we don't see an opportunity to practice some of our lesser achieved skills. And it's important for us to train even more and maintain our skills at an even higher level of readiness because we don't get to use them every day. And I think that's one of the things that shows off the dedication of services like the University of Vermont Rescue and College EMS Squad and other small organizations and rural organizations that are out there. And I think we need to just remember that we're all in this together, and I hope to share a lot of that through here at the Medicast. So thanks for your comments, Ben, and I look forward to hearing more from you soon. If you run into anything interesting up there, please send it down my way here at podmedic@mac.com. Let's jump right on into this week's news. This week's news has a lead-off item that deals with losing weight and getting in better shape, and it's something we all can do. Me, definitely. And so I just thought this story kind of caught my eye as a different way to encourage us to stay on target when we make those kind of resolutions. This comes out of the EastBayRhodeIsland.com site and deals with the Tiverton area firefighters, where 14 of them lost over 150 pounds over a course of 3 months using a Biggest Loser style contest. Based on the TV show that they watched, or several of them watched, they began their own Tiverton Fire Department Biggest Loser contest. The department has 32 career firefighters, and 14 of them participated in the competition that ran from the beginning of January through April. And the winner, after the fourth and final weigh-in, was a probationary firefighter who shed 33.5 pounds over the three-month period, down from 221 pounds to 188 pounds. This is really great and a neat opportunity and idea on urging and encouraging all of us to get into better shape. Maybe you have a friendly competition with a neighboring service and decide to have your own Biggest Loser style contest. This is a great reminder for all of us that I know it's hard for us to eat right on the job. I know we're sitting in our units all day and we have rapid periods of movement where we go after and get the patient and then we're back sitting in our units again. And we rush from fast food to the next call. It's just hard for us. So we need to find interesting ways to motivate ourselves to stay on track. And this is just a great idea. And I applaud them. I think this is fantastic. 14 of them losing 150 pounds or more is a great, great program. And I'm sure they're all feeling a lot better because of it. So thanks and congratulations to the members of the Tiverton Fire Department who came up with this great idea. Every week, it seems, I end up talking somewhere in some way of my show about training issues, about getting more training, about having opportunities to increase your level of care, to provide for training for new providers. And this is a big issue. This is something that there are a lot of cities and counties and jurisdictions out there that are struggling to get new providers, especially areas in rural parts of the country where they just don't have the ability to spend a lot of money on such things. And yet there are ways to do this without forcing us to pay the brunt of it. And I think one of those places is Schererville, Indiana. Schererville, Indiana Fire Department will be having a 10-month paramedic training course for existing EMTs, and the in-house program will save Schererville taxpayers $52,000 and nearly double the number of firefighters equipped to provide ALS medical services. The local medical center, St. Anthony Medical Center, is sponsoring this program in cooperation with another hospital, St. Margaret Mercy Hospital in the Dreyer, Indiana area. And it's going to come about because the town will spend $3,000 to train each firefighter as a paramedic. They will have to sign a reimbursement contract and will have to repay all or a portion of that amount if they leave the department within 3 years after finishing the program and getting their certification. Right now, the department has 16 full-time and part-time paramedics, but they want to get that number up there. And this is just another way to provide an incentive to get that training and a way for people to get that training done without breaking the bank, without forcing us to go out there and spend money on tuition to get these programs ourselves. There should be a way for us to get that done in other ways. And I applaud Schererville and other jurisdictions that are doing this kind of thing to find ways to fund training for EMS personnel. Whether it's paid personnel or volunteer, it's money well spent because it comes back to your community in so many ways. And going along with in providing better training, it's also important for us to continue our move towards providing safer ambulances and more modern techniques for building and arranging those ambulances. And this has come up in many different places. I found a story about Baldwin, Arizona EMS providers getting a brand new ambulance. Medic 515 will be specifically designed to provide safer conditions for EMS providers, and it is the centerpiece of what they're calling ASAP, which is the Baldwin EMS Ambulance Safety Awareness Program. They want everybody to see what they've done. They've included many safety features in this new ambulance, including better seatbelt arrangements, higher ceilings, enclosed padded areas and corners, easier access to supplies, and different things that they've done in the arrangement of the ambulance that allow providers to wear their seatbelts at all times. None of this means anything if you don't bother to wear your seatbelt in the back of the ambulance, but I think this is really the direction we need to go. We tell people to wear their seatbelts all the time, and we certainly see the number of deaths and injuries caused every year in the backs of ambulances to the providers of care because they aren't properly seatbelted in. In many cases, when I report on these kind of injuries, we see the patient who is strapped to the stretcher have some injury, but not severe injuries, while the provider who is thrown against the bulkhead by sliding down the bench seat into a storage cabinet or into a corner get broken bones, sustain severe internal injuries, or even worse, die as a result of that collision. And it's just something we need to be ever aware of and really change our focus and not be putting on some kind of stupid bravado about why we don't have to wear seatbelts in the back of the ambulance. Yeah, there are times where we might need to unbuckle to get care done. There are things that we do that are outside the range of normal sometimes. But how many of those calls do we really ride on where once we've set up and gotten moving, we really don't need to be getting out of our seats? We can talk to the patient, continue to get our history and monitor vitals and things. We can even push our meds safely sitting down. All of this gets me back to the topic of this month's GEMS issue. And you can check out John Bignell's EMS Live podcast. A couple weeks ago, he talked with AJ Heitman, the editor-in-chief over at GEMS magazine, and they discussed a little bit about his recent editorial that deals with ambulance design and new and innovative ambulance designs that may be on the horizon. And I would like to see this personally. I think we really need to get away from the box design of an ambulance that we have and focus on newer and better ways to provide care in the back of an ambulance. There's got to be a way for us to redesign the standard box ambulance we have and open it up a little bit, make it not so restrictive in space, and find ways for us to get care to our patients and maintain our own personal safety as well. Otherwise, that whole issue of saying scene safety in BSI isn't going to do us any good because we didn't arrive at the scene safely. And that's part of it. That's part of scene safety, is getting there safely. All right, I'm off my soapbox, but check out this article from Baldwin, Arizona EMS. It's a great little story about one agency that's taking steps to make ambulances safer. Moving along, you may remember a couple months ago I reported on a study that talked about the discrepancy in care for heart attack patients between rural and urban hospitals, between larger and smaller healthcare facilities, and the fact that you were more likely to suffer a death by going to some of these hospitals later in the evening or over the weekends when they were not fully staffed. Well, hospitals in Iowa and rural hospitals in other parts of the country have taken offense at this, and I don't blame them. They took issue with the way that study handled some of its math and some of its considerations on how they looked at their data. And so these other hospitals have commissioned a study, specifically in Iowa's rural hospitals, where they looked at data from 119 urban and rural hospitals in the state of Iowa. And they used a different analytic method than previous research approaches, and they wanted to rule out some things that are specific to small rural hospitals because they didn't take into account certain biases or other factors that would make people want to stay at a rural hospital rather than go to an urban hospital. Also, that longer transport times for urban hospitals may keep people going to local hospitals when they're in worse condition. And this is true. Rural hospitals have access to some of the same life-saving measures, and they certainly are equipped to deal with at least triaging heart attack patients. So the difference seemed to have come down to the availability of certain interventions and diagnostic facility techniques that were not available after hours or on the weekends. And I had some comments about this, and I still have some feelings about it. But this particular study that looked at that again for the state of Iowa found that many patients who have heart attacks, especially unstable elderly patients, families may request that they stay local in the community so that the family can provide care for them and support for them closer to home. Also, patients who were more sick or requiring more stabilization had to stay at the local hospital longer and were more likely to die because of the severity of their illness. Whereas those who were able to be easily stabilized and likely to be in more health and have a better outcome were transferred on to a larger facility for more definitive care. And so this study takes offense at the statements made by the study earlier. And I guess I agree with some of the things they say. I still think that this is an issue, and it's certainly important for us in EMS to be very aware of what the local hospitals around us can and cannot provide and how quickly they can provide access to those services. So talk to your doctors, talk to your supervisors, and some of the more experienced people in your service if you're brand new. Find out what hospitals in your area have access to things like CAT scans, have access to things like even 24-hour x-ray care in-house. I know that there are some local hospitals near me that call in an x-ray technician after hours and on weekends because they don't feel the need to have somebody in-house 24/7. So they only have someone in the house during the day and during the day on Saturday and Sunday for limited hours. And after hours on the weekdays and weekends, they have somebody on call. And they can be as far away as 30 to 40 minutes. So why do we take patients to certain hospitals and not to others? Because we need to make sure that they get the definitive care that they need in a timely fashion. And that we need to kind of look at. Maybe we don't have these kind of choices. In my area, I have 3 different local hospitals to choose from. And sometimes I make decisions on transport based upon what I know to be going on at those local hospitals at any given time. And that's my call. And I think that's something that you guys need to make calls on as well. So be aware of these things. And I'll keep looking at this particular study and others that I'm sure are going to come out, because this seems to be one of the hot button issues between hospitals in rural and urban arenas at this time. Who gets the patients in the end? Finally, I found a very interesting story that just caught my eye right away over at emsresponder.com, and it had to do with a Wisconsin woman who lost her hand in a chocolate vat as a result of an industrial accident. She was working at a chocolate plant when she stuck it into a machine that was still running, stuck her hand into a machine, and lost her right hand. The hand was discovered in the machine in a large amount of chocolate. They were able to turn off the machine, disengage it, and locate the hand and recover it. And then they began to rapidly transport the patient to the hospital. According to local reports, she was taken to a local hospital where surgeons were attempting to reattach the hand. The patient was conscious and alert and answering questions. Interestingly, and this is what really caught my eye, this is not the first time rescue crews were called into this local plant in Kenosha. They were called there in August of last year for a 21-year-old patient who got stuck in a vat of 120-degree chocolate for hours and suffered some burns when he tried to clear a clog from a machine. And the situation was very unusual, but one of the quotes from the local rescuers really caught my eye. They said, "We aren't really firefighters. We aren't really EMS providers. We're problem solvers." And I think that's the best statement that can be made about what we do. You know, you can learn how to treat different things. I can give you all the tips and tricks of the week up and down. The most important thing that you need to learn, and I'm not sure it's anything that I or anyone else can teach you, the most important thing you can learn is how to be innovative, how to think on your feet, and how to apply what you know to new and interesting situations when they come along. Every motor vehicle accident you encounter is going to be different. Some of them are going to have similarities, but really what you're going to run into is going to change the way you handle rescue in situations. Every kind of industrial accident where somebody gets trapped is different because machines are so different in their construction. And do you have to cut your way in from below? Do you have to come in from the side or from the top? Do you have to dismantle the whole machine? There are just so many different things to do. And in the midst of that, you have to deal with handling patient care. And these are things that we need to just be aware of and find ways to handle and deal with. And so we are innovators. We are problem solvers in what we do. And that's one of the things that I think draws many of us to this. Yeah, it's the adrenaline rush. But part of that adrenaline rush is wondering what you're going to see when you come around the corner and arrive at the scene. What are you going to come into? And the unknown nature of what every patient presents with when you get to their house or their place of business. And so we need to be aware of things like patients stuck in industrial equipment. And we need to be aware of other ways that patients can become injured or burned or suffer exposure to poisons or toxins or suffer illnesses. All of these things change with every single call. And that's one of the things that makes our job so exciting. Well, that last story kind of leads me into this week's tip and trick of the week, and that is burn assessment and burn treatment in the field. And I'm just going to do a quick overview here. I think all of us have our own resources and our own training on how to deal with burns, but sometimes it's a good idea to review some of the key topics. So I'm going to go ahead and hit the high points of burn management, and I'm going to urge you to look at your own protocols, especially to find out what specialty centers you have close by and what your protocol says about transporting to which hospital to deal with these things. First of all, we need to remember that burns are the body's response to injuries to the skin, underlying muscles, bone, nerves, and blood vessels. And these are caused by a variety of sources. And it's important for us to assess the source of the burn. They may be caused by thermal access or thermal contact, including hot gases, hot liquids, and hot surfaces as a result of many different sources of trauma. And this may be as a result of explosion, as a result of a fire, and as the result of household accidents like brushing up against something hot or spilling hot liquids on yourself. And unfortunately, also abuse. There also may be chemical burns caused by acids or bases or other caustic agents, electrical burns, radiation, and light also may cause burns. And the key thing here is to remember that we need to get the patient out of the source of the burn. If you have somebody with really bad sunburn, you need to get that patient out of the sun. And if you have a patient that is lying on the road and has injuries from a motor vehicle accident and you don't want to move them because you suspect a spinal injury, but they're laying in a puddle of hot radiator fluid, you need to be aware of these kind of things and get them out of the source of the burn. And if necessary, you may need to take steps to cool the surface area down. If their skin is still actively burning, you may need to do things like cut open a bag of your IV solution, which is sterile inside, and pour that onto the surface of the burn. I know that doesn't necessarily apply if you're not dealing with a jurisdiction that has a moist dressing protocol, but we have to stop the source of the burn. And if the burn is still going on, you're causing more injury by just covering it up. You need to stop the source of the burn and then go ahead and dress your injuries. After you get done with that, you want to deal with the patient's pain and which hospital you're going to transport them to. Some of the things that I use in Maryland here as our jurisdictional protocol for indications for referral to a burn center include patients with second and third degree burns that have burns of 10% of their body surface area for patients that are under 10 or over 50, and burns of 20% of the body surface area for patients that are between those ages of 10 and 50. And anybody with burns to their face, hands, feet, or perineum, because these burns can greatly affect either functionality of the body part affected or the total body's health. And by that I mean, you know, if you have a burn to your face, you're more likely to have an airway burn because you breathed in hot gases or something. Or if you have a burn to your face, you may have localized soft tissue swelling that affects your ability to maintain your airway. Also, your hands and feet can be burned, and generally they include circumferential burns to the digits. And when you have a circumferential burn, you will cause damage distal to that because of constriction of blood flow and nutrients and perfusion. So all of these things can cause problems and functionality down the road. And of course, perineal burns inflict damage on our ability to void wastes out of our body systems. And if you think about it, if we have a perineal burn, we're more likely to have urethral swelling, swelling to our genitalia, and swelling to our bowel passages. And all of these things will restrict our ability to safely remove waste from our body. So these are reasons to transport somebody to the burn center. Also, electrical burns. Electrical burns do not follow a straight line path. Electrical burns can almost be considered like a penetrating wound or a gunshot wound, where you can see where the bullet enters and you can see where the bullet exits, but you have no idea where exactly the bullet traveled in between. And the same thing goes for any kind of electrical burn, because the electricity does not always follow the straight line path in the body. It will travel in different pathways and cause injuries in many different surface areas internally, and that needs to be assessed by a specialty center. Chemical burns often are indications for transport to a burn center, and anybody with an inhalation injury or a circumferential burn, as I talked about earlier. Your treatment options include eliminating the source of the burn, determining the body surface area, And the depth of the burn, including first-degree burns, would be burns to the surface area of the skin, often evidenced by redness or swelling at the site of the burn. Second-degree burns are partial thickness burns, and you'll see blistering at the site. And third-degree burns are full thickness burns that have burned through all layers and down often to the bone. And this type of burn, you will see charring, blackened skin, those kind of things. So you assess the surface area and the depth of the burn. Use your rule of nines chart. You all have access to that in your training materials. And you want to treat any associated trauma, dress the wounds appropriately according to your protocol, and then transport to the appropriate receiving facility. So that's a quick overview of burn treatment and burn assessment. I hope that helps you guys out the next time you have a patient with burns. And that's going to be this week's tip and trick of the week. This week's med of the week is going to be the drug Haldol. Haloperidol is a medication that is used as a form of chemical restraint in some services and is often used in concert with physical restraint use for violent patients. Haloperidol, or Haldol, is an anxiolytic agent and is very effective in the management of aggressive and violent patients. It also has anti-emetic properties and may be used in the management of severe nausea and vomiting, and has weak anticholinergic effects, so it can act somewhat like atropine and is an alpha-blocking agent causing vasodilation. The onset of action for Haldol when administered IM is acting within 10 minutes, and the indications for the use of the drug are the chemical restraint of violent or agitated and aggressive patients who may present a danger to themselves or to others who cannot be safely managed otherwise. Most violent agitated patients can be handled with verbal and physical restraint alone. However, when you need to get patients restrained in other ways, it's just time to do it. I know that there's a strong move away from the use of chemical and physical restraints in facility handling of patients, but in many cases, this is because these facilities have access to other resources and additional personnel, and we don't always have that luxury. We often are transporting in a two-person transport situation. We got a driver up front and a provider in the back, and that person is alone with another person who is violent. It causes a great deal of stress to the provider to have to deal with that, especially when the patient is not willing to calm down on their own. So we need to make sure that this gets taken care of. The drug is contraindicated in children under the age of 6, in patients with Parkinson's disease, in patients with any kind of central nervous system depression or acute central nervous system injury. And the reason for this is that this can have an increased incidence of seizure-like activity when used in patients that have these issues. Adverse effects that you need to be aware of include extrapyramidal symptoms or a dystonic reaction, and is the most common side effect that may be seen, but generally it is not encountered in patients where the use of Haldol is in short term. And that's something we're likely not to see unless you transport a lot of patients with psychiatric problems. Generally, these symptoms can be treated with a single dose of diphenhydramine of 25 to 50 milligrams to handle the symptoms that you may see in these cases. Also, hypotension and tachycardia are common, but generally are self-limiting. But if you do see significant drops in blood pressure, a fluid challenge would be indicated. So this is one of those meds, if you're able to, you might need to start an IV ahead of time. Again, I don't know if I see that happening with a patient that's already violent. And since this medication is often administered by IM means in violent patients, you may not have an opportunity to get that IV established ahead of time. Precautions that need to be taken when administering this drug for violent patients: Probably the patient needs to be physically restrained while you're administering the medication. And this is because, you know, the patient's already flailing around. We certainly don't need to add insult to injury by putting you in danger of a needle stick or them in danger of having an injury from the injection itself, not just related to the drug. So make sure that you're having enough people to handle physical restraint while you administer the chemical restraint. Also, be aware that this may mask your evaluation of the patient down the road because you're going to be administering them a medication that is an anti-anxiety medication. One thing you need to be aware of, this drug does not usually have significant sedative effects, but some patients may have a sedative-like reaction. So you're not going to be putting the patient to sleep with this medication. What you are going to do is give this medication and have the patient react by having weakened response or just not caring about what bothered them before anymore. So that's kind of the way this medication works in the field, in my experience. Dosages that you probably see are anywhere from 5 to 10 milligrams IM or IV in patients between the ages of 16 and 69 years of age. And for elderly patients, you want to cut those medications down a little bit, maybe as much as going to 0.5 to 2.5 milligrams IM or IV. For patients less than 6 years of age, this drug is contraindicated. But if you do have a violent child of older age, you'll want to consider maybe 0.05 milligrams per kilogram up to a max of 2.5 milligrams for these patients when they're pediatric patients. Again, that's Haldol, also known as haloperidol, and it's a chemical restraint drug. And that's this week's MedicCast Med of the Week. And I think that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show. Make sure you get in contact with me if you have any comments or questions or corrections on anything I've talked about in tonight's episode. You can reach me by emailing me here at podmedic@mac.com. You can also call in on the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. You can check out the show at the podcast site at medicast.com. Over there, you can leave comments as well. And I usually try to get 3 or 4, maybe 5 extra posts of information, links, and interesting articles that I find throughout the week. So make sure you head back on over and visit medicast.com over at the website there. There will also be links to everything that I've talked about tonight in the show notes over at the website, so you can check that out there. I want to thank you for supporting the show in all of the ways you do so, whether it's rating the podcast over at the iTunes store or voting for the show over at Podcast Alley or just visiting the website and sharing the podcast and the website with people you know. All of these are great ways that you help support the podcast, and I appreciate that. If you're interested in getting an email newsletter sent to you every week, you can sign up for the MedicCast newsletter over at the website. It's absolutely free, and every week that I post an episode or have some important information to send to you, I can do that, and you'll get all of the links sent directly to your email box, and you can find out when the show's been posted. And you can do that over at the website in the upper right-hand corner. Sign up for the MedicCast newsletter for free. And just for MedicCast newsletter listeners, every single week there's a free extra tip of the week at the end of the newsletter. Just a little something extra to send you on your way. And thank you for signing up for the MedicCast newsletter. Well, I think that's enough of me talking here. It's time to send you all on your way. I want to thank you for checking out the show and checking out the website and supporting all of the advertisers over at the MedicCast site. I certainly appreciate that and continue to do so. It helps out the show in many, many ways. I will send you on your way, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music. This week, again, from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This week's music is from an artist by the name of Sebastian Gomez, And he has a great little tune here, just kind of something to settle you down and relax you on your way out the door, called One Day. Until next week, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Scene safety, BSI.
Get your hands so dirty every time you try and make it. To me, you're always pretty, but it seems you go and fake it. Around you, all is perfect, and you don't want to see the people who can bend it or that you just try to be. A simple little smile, a twinkle in your eye, that makes you walk the mile, makes you happy for a while. One day, you will know what I'm talking about. One day, you will go but not without a fight. And if you ever can't trust and you wanna let it out, let your guard down, fly straight to my heart. One day. It don't matter how tall, it don't matter how small, just stop flipping through pages of what you think is all. A simple little tear will wash away your fears and turn it upside down and make a smile from a frown. One day, you will know what I'm talking about. One day, you will go but not without a fight. And if you ever can't trust and you wanna let it out, let your guard down, fly straight to my heart. No matter how hard I try, your love keeps me awake. And into your lonely nights, I hope you hear me say, you get your hands so dirty every time you try and make it. To me, you're always pretty, but it seems you go and fake it. Around you, all is perfect, and you don't wanna see the people who can bend it and that you just try to be. One day, you will know what I'm talking about. One day, you will go but not without a fight. If you ever can't trust and you wanna let it out, let your guard down, fly straight to my heart. One day, you will know what I'm talking about. One day, you will go but not without a fight. And if you ever can't trust and you wanna let it out, let your guard down, fly straight to my heart. One day. One day.